and welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage at This Wreckage podcast, formerly known as Antifada. And I guess that means that we are now Too Fast to Wreckager. Today we're talking about Sanguinetti, and I'm going to let Andy introduce this. We also are missing Sean today. He's not feeling well, but we do have an additional guest, and I will let Andy introduce him as well.
Hey, everybody. So we're going to talk today about Gianfranco Sanguinetti, who we actually had planned this episode a couple weeks ago. We started talking about it after the tragic assassination of Charles Kirk and the immediate counterterrorism repressive measures following that. And so mostly we're going to focus on a text he wrote in 1979, Terrorism and the State, sort of reflecting on the years of lead, the strategy of tension, Gladio, all that stuff in Italy. And then actually the day that we had first discussed recording, we heard the news that he passed away in Prague. So rest in peace, Sanguinetti. We'll try to do his work justice today. And we have a guest who is currently in the U.S. studying Sanguinetti. Her name is Alex from the Balkan anarchist journal Antipolitica.
Hi.
She'll be off camera. She can tell us a lot about Sanguinetti. And so I was thinking maybe we could start on the sort of background of, you know, this historical background in which these texts were written, unless you have anything either of you want to add before we begin.
No, I think it's important to just go straight into it. Considering there's been a lot of years of lead talk and a lot of misunderstanding of what that was, you know, even comparing it to the Days of Rage in the United States, which is kind of misleading. So maybe it's good just in general that we have the context for that.
Yeah. And we'll also, you know, towards the fun half, we'll work our way towards applying these criticisms, this analysis to post 9/11 the United States, because that's when this text really got revived, was after 9/11 in left communist circles and elsewhere. But yeah, so to begin, of course, you have the hot summer in Italy, the sort of 68 style rioting and uprisings across the country leading into the oil crisis in 73, straining the Italian economy, sort of roiling the communist and socialist economic restructuring of the country. The PCI, the Italian Communist Party, does win 34% in the 1976 election, which I think was their highest vote count, at least in quite a while. Their candidate Berlinguer supports the Christian Democrats in a historic compromise, which would allow the communists to be a governing partner in exchange for moderating the wage demands of the union and accepting austerity. In 1975, Gianfranco Sanguinetti had been a situationist since 69. And had written some texts with the board, including a text that announced the schism, the sort of dissolution of the Situationists in 71. And
there was an Italian section.
So the Italian section continued past 71?
No. It dissolved in 70 or 71.
Okay. Yeah.
So it was just a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
They published just one issue of their journal.
The Situationists are dissolved, but Sanguinetti and Debord are still working together, still writing together.
Mm-hmm.
And in 75, he publishes True Report on the Last Chances of Saving Capitalism in Italy under the pseudonym Censor. And this text was a description of how and why the state manufactures terrorist acts like the Piazza Fontana bombing. And it was sent to Italy's elite and widely believed to be a real document, causing widespread speculation about who wrote it. And Sanguinetti later revealed that he was behind the hoax. It was an attempt to create his own false flag to reveal the false flag methods of the state in, you know, for example, arming the fascist Ordine Nuovo to do these attacks and justify the state's repression on the left and on the right in an attempt to stop communism, divert a civil war, protect the state, that sort of thing. So shortly after, there's the movement of 77, these widespread riots and revolts throughout mostly the north of Italy. And then in 78, there's the kidnapping of Christian Democrat PM Aldo Moro by the Red Brigades, and he is held hostage and eventually killed. And that's a prelude to a hard crackdown on the ultra-left and the eventual collapse of this historic compromise between the center and the communists. And so during this time in 79, Sanguinetti writes a new text sort of tracing the use of terrorism by Italian secret services as a way of crushing the left, of increasing its repressive apparatus, of legitimizing the state in general. I should note that from this text, it sounds like Sanguinetti was one of the earliest or most fervent mainstream intellectuals claiming that the kidnapping of Moro had been done by the state, which was, it sounds like, not the common position at the time. Although in 1999, ex-Red Brigade members testified that the kidnapping had been plotted by infiltrators who were running the organization. So that seems to justify everything he says in the text. Although I'm not too clear on the specific details of all of these terrorist incidents, but it does seem like the Italian state was very good at orchestrating and manipulating acts of terrorism for its purposes.
Which shouldn't be surprising to us. I mean, like, when you look at a lot of the comparison here to the Days of Rage and even to post 9/11 America should be a little bit obvious, because a lot of the arrest that we saw around terrorist incidents on both the left and the right in the US, particularly after 2002, were entrapment cases. Mm-hmm. You know, that were legal, but nonetheless, it was informants promoting more radical, in quotation, actions that then they could use as a pretext to arrest members of the group. Like, and we also know that COINTELPRO did that constantly in the 60s. So
I guess, you know, we'll get into it later, but I think it's important when people talk about domestic Gladio, American Gladio, Gladio 2, all that stuff, to recognize both the specific conditions within Italy during this time, the strength of the left and ultra left in Italy during this time, the crisis that put the state into, and that similarly in the American context, operations like COINTELPRO were far more complex and capable than what we've seen from the state after 9/11. You know, these the sort of entrapment cases were nowhere near as crafty as what COINTELPRO was doing, because the threat, I think, was far less severe. But we'll get into that. Maybe at this point we can read parts of the text and discuss it.
Yeah, let's go there. What would you like to focus in on?
Well, I pulled out quite a few quotes here. Maybe we can just sort of go through them and jump in. So this is from On Terrorism in the State, 1979. All acts of terrorism, all the attacks that have struck and that strike the imagination of men and women have been and are either offensive or defensive actions. Experience has long since shown that if they are part of a strategic offensive, they are always doomed to failure. On the other hand, experience has shown that if they are part of a defensive strategy, such actions can hope for some success, which is nevertheless momentary and precarious. The attacks by the Palestinians and the Irish, for example, are acts of offensive terrorism, while the bombing of the Piazza Fontana and the kidnapping of Aldo Moro are, for example, defensive acts. The desperate and those suffering from illusions have recourse to offensive terrorism, while it is always and only the state that has recourse to defensive terrorism, either because they have been thrust into some serious social crisis, as the Italian state has been, or because they fear such a crisis, as does the German state. So I guess maybe we can talk a little bit about the context here. What do you make of this offensive, defensive line? Why was the Italian state particularly in crisis this moment?
I would love the context for this in the case of the Italian state. I mean, the offensive versus defensive is interesting, because when I read this, I was not entirely clear about why the state would do defensive would be doing defensive terrorism, but I do get the general logic that you'd have to be in favor of the status quo in some form for defensive terrorism to work. And I was thinking about this about like why like certain kinds of right wing stochastic leaderless resistance terrorism is effective, what it's trying to achieve, because it's trying to halt action. And effectively parts of it are in defense of, even though it might be against a liberal government, it's defense of a larger status quo. Whereas offensive terrorism being doomed to failure, I mean, he doesn't go into it here, but that reminds me of like Lenin talking about this in like 1905, mm-hmm. You know, that it just, it promotes reaction. It can't muster enough of the masses to actually overthrow the state. It basically becomes a kind of weakened propaganda by the deed. But I would still like to know the context specifically for, you know, the late 60s, early 70s in Italy, because I think there's something I'm missing.
Because you don't think the state was particularly thrown into crisis?
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure the Italian state was thrown into crisis, but I'm not sure, like, what the specific crisis, why was it so much more acute in Italy than in Germany, for example? I mean, mm-hmm. You know, they had similar problems.
What do you think, Alex?
I think he generally explains a little bit more specifically about the Piazza Fontana bombing in the Truthful Report, and then mm-hmm. a little bit more about Aldo Moro on terrorism in the state. So maybe I would say something first about Piazza Fontana.
Yeah.
Like, how would I frame it? Like, I would say he writes a little bit chaotic on this issue, like why the state uses terrorism or generally like actions of secret services. He makes some very general statements about it. Like, for example, I don't know, he says that the actions of secret services and like the terrorism that they do are a general part, are not something extraordinary. This has always been part of every state. Especially modern states have always been terrorists, and like especially at their beginning and when faced with like their imminent demise. He quotes heavily various historical like statehoods and military theorists such as Sun Tzu, Machiavelli, Guicciardini, Karl von Clausewitz and others. So he makes a lot of historical examples where some kind of deception was used to impose control. And then specifically about the modern state, he says that terrorism is an everyday part of life in the society of the spectacle, in a society ruled by the commodity. But then a little bit more specifically, you know how in the society of a spectacle, the Boer distinguishes between the diffused and the concentrated spectacle? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. So the concentrated spectacle is more reliant on, you know, concentrated state power, the figure of the leader, and so on.
Stalinism.
Yeah. And then the fuse is the opposite, so more reliant on, let's say, the mute compulsion of the economy. And then in the comments to the society of spectacle, he comes up with the integrated spectacle, which is a combination of the two. And I would say, under the influence of Sanguinetti, he sees the integrated spectacle, so maybe to describe it a little bit, what De Boer says about it. So for him, it's this is characterized. Integrated spectacle is a characteristic of certain states, like from the late 70s and the 80s. He mentions Italy specifically and different countries in Latin America. So it's a combination of like neoliberal economy, new technologies of communication, surveillance, informal racket economies, and a lot of state violence. So under the influence of Sanguinetti, this kind of society of the spectacle, the integrated spectacle, is for him like unprecedented kind of unity between capitalist economy and the modern state, and also an unprecedented kind of unity, identity between essence and appearance. And here I would say that he was heavily under influence of Sanguinetti, but for Sanguinetti, this kind of unity is not only characteristic of the society of a spectacle since the 70s, but was always the characteristic of the rule of the bourgeoisie. And for him, this is something that started like from the French Revolution on. So in this sense, he talks how the actions of secret services, fake news, false flag terrorism, and things like this are only an addition to a more fundamental deception. And he, in the Remedy for Everything, so this is the Remedy for Everything is a non-published manuscript of which Terrorism and the State is just one chapter that was published. So in Remedy for Everything, he uses this concept of social organization of generalized lies, which reminded me a little bit of, I don't know if you know this social organization of appearances. It's a concept that Eric John Russell uses in his book. And then, so he explains how the bourgeoisie, since the French Revolution on, used journalism and, you know, parliamentary representation of citizens, and how these practices serve. So for him, they represent this more fundamental deception. And yes, this practice of political representation was later further enforced by the like union representation of workers and so on. And for him, representation generally always plays the game of the bourgeoisie because it channels workers' dissent or any kind of dissent into demands that do not put into question the value form and the state form. And the same role has this, sorry for my English, maybe I'm talking a little bit
confused. You're doing good.
So the same role has this, like how he explains this social organization of generalized. So it's, as also Eric John Russell says, it's a logic of unity in separation. So it's this appearance that the economy and the state are separated, that there is a separation of the left and the right inside of one nation state, or the separation between democratic and totalitarian regimes. So for him, these apparent separations, which are in fact not, also serve this purpose of channeling revolts into something that can be absorbed by the value form and the state. And he writes like very much how the revolts of that time in Italy, especially in the late 60s, were wild, were outside the framework of union negotiation. The workers were rioting, burning down courts, police cars and everything, refusing any kind of structure that would be imposed by like, you know, the unions or the Communist Party, etc. So maybe to say it, they were not acting collectively as a commodity owner. And this is like a requirement, like for capitalism to work, workers have to collectively behave like good owners of their labor powers as a commodity. And this was not the case in Gianfranco's opinion. So specifically about the Piazza Fontana, he mentions that on the 19th of November of that year, so 69, there was an attempt by unions to channel the revolts into something more acceptable. So they organized like a national general strike over the question of rent. But in Milan, the workers completely... like they didn't like this idea. They made fun of the unions, the union leaders and everybody, and they started a riot. So they occupied like the center of the city, erected barricades, and neither the police or the unions were capable of doing anything about it. And for Sanguinetti...
Sorry, we're talking about 77 now?
No, 69.
Okay.
And so for him, this was the reason why on the 12th of December, the bombs in Piazza Fontana and also in Rome exploded, because for the state didn't have any other possibility of calming down these riots. So I would say that because he criticizes a lot of this, actually this, this tactic, he, especially in the Truthful Report, he says that the Italian bourgeoisie is very incompetent. So the political class is not serving anymore the true bourgeoisie. But for him, the bombings on Piazza Fontana represented like the true measure of the strength of the proletarian movement. On the one side, they showed like the strength of the movement because such a very like violent provocation was needed to be able to stop the movement, but then also its weakness, because obviously it did work. The workers were completely disoriented. They stopped rioting, etc. However, later he thought that this strategy was used too much. He in the Truffaut report, he uses this phrase, gladium ancipitem in manus tulti, like a two-edged sword in the hand of a fool. So to describe how the political class in Italy used this kind of terrorism, he thought that it worked once and it was like good this one time, but then it became the source of all future failures. And also in one manuscript, he underlined this word gladium, and he wrote that this is probably this word was probably what made power think that he was one of them, because I guess they would understand it as a reference to gladio.
And that wasn't public knowledge at the time.
What was not public knowledge?
Operation Gladio.
No.
Okay, so he,
as far as I know,
he may have just accidentally used a word that convinced them he was actually one of them in this hoax document.
Yes, I'm not sure when exactly did he made this this note, but it was after it was published, as far as I know. But maybe just important to mention, the Italian section, so not only him but also Pavan and Salvadori, they published a text, "Is the Reichstag Burning?" I think 7 days after the bombing, mm-hmm. where they already said this same thesis that he explains in the Truffaut report, just very shortly. And also a month later, the group Lud also published a text with a similar thesis. The text was called Bombe Sangue Capitale, Bombs Blood Capital.
So the Piazza Fontana burning, although it achieved its immediate objectives of like putting a chilling effect through the movement, it also led to this, I guess, anti-fascist resurgence in the Italian left, right? Because it was considered a fascist attack. But then also this kind of wave of paranoia where everyone kind of thought this was probably the work of the state in some degree as well.
I don't think that immediately after everybody thought it was the state. I think it was just the Italian section and the Lud who had this thesis. A lot of, for example, anarchist groups immediately distanced themselves from Valpreda and Pinelli, which Sanguinetti thought was like very cowardly. So it did create a lot of disorientation among anarchists, leftists, and others.
But he writes about later in the text that first of all, the historical synchronicity between the Italians creating fascism as a way of crushing the post 1917 communist movement in Italy, and then the creation of these spectacular acts of terrorism aimed at workers' demonstrations as a sort of similar function or a similar sophistication of the Italian state, but that between Piazza Fontana and the kidnapping of Moro, the security state was sort of thrown into something of a crisis as a result of the failures of the investigations that came. So I'm just unclear about like what the mentality of, or like what the public perception of Piazza Fontana was by 77, 78.
It was not known at that time that it was done by a far right fascist group. This was not.
Oh, I didn't. Okay.
They were convicted. They had a hearing only in 1987, but they were not convicted, and only later they were. It was confirmed that it was like people from Ordine Nuova, but this was not public knowledge in the 70s. Is this what you mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, what did people think of Piazza Fontana? Who do they think did it?
There was definitely an idea on the left that it could be fascists. This idea was present, but I wouldn't say that there was some kind of consensus on who did it.
I mean, there's a... The issues with this are manifold, because it reminds me of every time in the last 20 years has been an assassination. We start speculating wildly about who and what did it. And particularly if there isn't a suspect, or maybe even in some cases a patsy, The thing is that when you deal with Gladio, you're walking a very thin line, because that we know that there was government conspiracies around these issues. We know that for a fact. It's been declassified. But we don't always know who's in charge, what they were, and how they were being used. I find that to be like a maddening problem, to be completely honest. Like, it's like, because on one hand, just to make a comparison to when we wanted to talk about this when Charlie Kirk was shot, there was immediately speculation about like Mossad being involved from both the left and the right. It's still being promoted by implication at the Gray Zone and at Candace Owens.
Yeah, I would argue it's the mainstream right-wing position.
Right. Well, it's the mainstream right-wing position for the right-wing that's not in government.
Yeah, the mainstream edgy right-wing position.
Right. It's also not an uncommon left-wing position. I mean... Mm-hmm.
The left loves it. Or they at least love that the right likes this idea.
I mean, the problem with it is, like, unlike with Operation Gladio, I don't know the mechanism, whereas Mossad could have gotten to a 21-year-old Southern Utah ex-Mormon who happened to be in a relationship with a trans person who then also was at a different school than the one he went to and had significant hunting experience. I don't know how you'd find that on Discord. but at the same token, like, we know that these kinds of provocations happen. Like, we know, even if the state's not doing the violence directly, they are often goading people to do the violence for multiple aims. So it's a hard thing to square, and I don't know. I feel really weird speculating about, like, a bombing that precipitated a left-wing crisis that, you know, I don't have the context for, because I don't want to deny the possibility that it was state or parastate actors, but I also don't want to say it was without hard evidence, you know?
I feel like the evidence for Piazza Fontana was that the explosives that they used were from these Gladio stockpiles or whatever. So this, some state agent must have passed it off to the fascists.
I mean, that feels pretty likely.
Go ahead. I mean, it was confirmed that the intelligence service of the Italian military, at the time it was called SID, was involved in obstructing the investigation and protecting the perpetrators.
And then,
that's a surprise at all.
But yeah, I mean, it seems like Piazza Fontana specifically, there wouldn't be, unlike Aldo Moro, you know, the kidnapping of Aldo Moro, there was a clear, you know, he was photographed in front of the Red Brigade's flag. There was communiques put out by the Red Brigades explaining why they would do this. It's unclear to me what the confusion would be about Piazza Fontana, like why a left-wing group would do it. Maybe there was some attempt to blame the anarchist wing for this, but I don't know why the anarchists would put a bomb in that location at that time. Like, what would the motive be?
I have no idea,
go ahead. I mean, I wasn't implying that it would have been left-wing. It doesn't make any sense to me as a left-wing act. Like, I feel weird trying to speculate on saying I know who did it, because this is not an area where I'm very, very, very strong. I've read a lot on Gladio, but not actually more on Moro than this.
Okay. But getting back to the sort of argument that he's making here is that, you know, it's not that there are never instances of left-wing armed struggle and that could be called terrorism, but that when the left does it, it's desperate. In the case of Palestine or the IRA specifically that he references here, that like other more effective means like a general strike or, you know, citywide shutdown, that sort of thing have like reached the point where it was no longer gaining momentum, or that the repression is so high that the militants are sent underground, and so they have to start carrying out these like paramilitary procedures. And so that desperation, he claims, is always doomed to failure. Whereas the state orchestrates these things offensively as a prelude to a further crackdown on the left, either directly or through paramilitaries. And the direct coordination is against their population specifically, which was something that at the time there's a lot of skepticism that the state would ever directly attack their population or even members of their political class like Moro. And so there was, for example, a discourse around the time that the Red Brigades clearly did this action, but it was the state's fault because they let it happen and they wouldn't save Moro. And so that was sort of the discourse that Sanguinetti's weighing in on here, which is that, no, the state probably indirectly coordinated it. And the fact that the state would allow Moro to be killed is really nothing out of the usual.
Yeah. I mean, that to me doesn't seem even kind of controversial. We know this happens a fair amount. And we know for a fact, I mean, we know for a fact in there this time period that both the fascist and the mafia were being used, I mean, from World War I into probably the 1980s as a check on left wing members of the government, and as a bulwark against the Italian Communist Party, like as almost official NATO policy.
Mm-hmm.
like that's not hidden anymore.
Yeah, specifically in the Aldo Moro kidnapping, apparently two members of the 'Ndrangheta were present, and probably one of them killed him because of the style of the shooting, like a circle around the heart.
Yeah, so to get into a little bit of the specifics of the kidnapping, Moro was driving down a street in Rome. The car gets blocked in and is descended upon by several people wearing Alitalia flight uniforms. And this is crucial because there were several actual left-wing militants there who were later in prison, and they said that not everyone who was participated in that initial kidnapping knew each other. They were just told to look for other militants there in this same pilot or stewardess flight uniform. And so several gunmen shot at Moro's handlers very precisely, not killing him, and then extracted him and took him to one or several safe houses in Rome, where he would communiques were issued demanding release of political prisoners, demanding money, that sort of thing, and finally killing him several days later. So this eventually comes out as, yes, the members of the Red Brigades did this, but they were doing it, they were able to pull it off, first of all, because there were non-Red Brigades members involved, because the Red Brigades themselves were, like, kind of goofy leftists like us, who, like, probably couldn't pull off something like that. And then also the motivations behind it are kind of unclear. Like, why would they... Okay, so they want to stop the communists from entering government because they want to make sure the Communist Party stays revolutionary. So why would they kidnap Moro and not Berlinger in that case?
Right.
But I think
we're going to go after the CPUSA, but we're kidnapping Bernie.
or we're going to go after the Democratic Party by kidnapping Hillary instead of Bernie or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also they never made any specific demands. Like, I think they kept him for 55 days, and there was never, like, a specific demand that they made, which is also what was a bit.
Wasn't there a demand for money and for?
This is what they usually did.
The release of prisoners. They didn't demand at that time.
In the moment when they kidnapped Moro, they were they had already a lot of money from kidnappings.
Okay.
So the official story was that it was about, I think, four or five members of the Red Brigades who kidnapped Moro, but later it was discovered that it was at least 20 people. And I think this parliamentary commission that revealed a lot of the details, that was done, I don't know, somewhere in the 2000s already, because his family insisted for a long time for an investigation to be made. So they said that it was like during this investigation they realized that it was absolutely impossible that in a matter of a couple of minutes, apparently it was less than 3 minutes, five of the cops in the two cars were killed and he was not even scratched. And that, you know, to do this you need to have a very good training.
Mm-hmm.
So for Sanguinetti this was obvious for some reason for the beginning, and also like how the state behaved. For example, the state paid two psychics to tell them the location of Moro, and for him this was like, okay, obviously this is very unserious, they are not even trying to find him.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this was also one of the things that made him suspect.
So maybe let's talk a little bit about who the Red Brigades were, because the next part of this text talks about how it says the strategists of the state's official services seek to give their own acts much greater credibility, or at least less improbability, either by directly claiming them in the name of the initials of this or that ghostly group, or even by getting them claimed by an existing clandestine group whose militants are apparently or believe themselves to be strangers to the designs of the state's apparatus. Who were the Red Brigades? What like role did they play in the Italian far left at that time?
I mean, they were a Marxist-Leninist group. They're still stated as officially responsible for the kidnapping and murder of Moro, even though, like, you know, even Steve Pachinik doesn't believe that. If you don't know who that guy is, he's an Alex Jones guest and claims to have been involved with Operation Gladio on this front. They wanted, I mean, one of their big demands was that Italy leave NATO. But it's interesting because you refer to them as a far left group, and they both are. But I think it needs to be very clear: by far left, we do not mean ultra left. They're not really associated with like the Italian ultra left.
They were more like RAF, and they saw themselves as sort of part of the Soviet project. Is that more accurate?
I mean, maybe Alex can answer. I mean, it seems to me that they at least saw themselves as picking up on like the kind of quasi Maoist protracted people's war tradition, because like the groups that they said to have been inspired by were like the Tupaneros of Uruguay and like the Algerian National Liberation Front. Mm. But again, that's just, you know, what I know from cursory readings on them.
Like they weren't like Lotta Continua or there were more like anarchist or like ultra left armed struggle groups that did kidnappings and stuff like that. But this wasn't, the Red Brigades were a bit more Stalinist. Is that right?
Yes, definitely not anarchist.
Okay. So he continues this critique of clandestine militant groups in general, that their clandestine hierarchy reflects a division of labor and the roles proper to the current social organization. Those on high decide what is to be done, and those below execute orders. Ideology and military discipline protect the true summit from all the risks and all the rank and file from suspicions. Any secret service intelligence agency can invent for itself a set of revolutionary initials and carry out a certain number of attacks for which the press will make good publicity, and from which secret service in question will find it easy to form a small group of naive militants who can direct and with the greatest ease. But in the case of a small terrorist group spontaneously constitutes itself, there is nothing easier in the world than for the detached units of the state to infiltrate it and substitute themselves for it, either by well-chosen arrests made at opportune moments or by the assassination of the original leaders, which in general rule takes place during an armed conflict with the forces of order, informed in advance of such and encountered by the infiltrated agent. So that made me immediately think of the SLA, where the kind of origins of that, of the leader of that group were always suspected to be, you know, he was working with the state to some extent in prison before he becomes the leader of this like extremely far left armed struggle group that, you know, thinks that the weathermen are cowards and, you know, leads his group into this, you know, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst and then this shootout with police in LA where they're all killed. But I guess this is, he's probably more talking about the RAF in this instance. And then mm-hmm. the Red Brigade as a group that was a real group that was easily infiltrated throughout the 70s.
Right. I mean, and it makes sense. I mean, like one of the things that you think about these groups is since they're clandestine and hierarchical, if you can infiltrate them, it's not hard to get them to do things that are counter to their own mission. And again, like if we talk about this, like this is not as sophisticated as COINTELPRO because COINTELPRO generally didn't have to promote like these kind of spectacular acts, but they did would say the Panthers, for example, they targeted people around leaders to promote divisions and do things that would open them up to attacks from normal street cops.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we know that's confirmed from declassified information that happened. So it's wild to me, you know, thinking about it. It does seem very obvious that these clandestine groups, one, they're super hierarchical, so they're really easy to take out key members of. And two, because they're underground, you know, whether they have to be or not, it's very, very easy for those members to be replaced by people who can get the whole organization to act counter to its interest. And I was just reading this. I keep thinking, like, isn't it ironic? I mean, that, like, you know, if you think about the critiques made by Marxists of, like, Bakunin or Lenin of the Russian nihilist and anarchist, that it's the Marxist-Leninist doing the thing that like the early Marxists were critiquing, quote, anarchists for doing, unquote. And I find that fascinating because we saw a lot of this in the 70s, not just in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And it did seem very easy to encourage. I mean, you know, another thing we know now is leaderless resistance, which has been mostly used by the right, but was developed by a former CIA military leader to promote on the left to be able to do broad crackdowns on the left because you could basically there's no structure or infrastructure even to rat out. And so you could use this to fight communism. And this feels similar. Like if you just think structurally about the problems of these kinds of actions, that they're really, really easy to be used to justify state repression. I mean, you know, and it is interesting that everyone's immediate and, you know, probably quite accurate, you know, analogy is the Reichstag fire. I mean, you know, we still talk about, I mean, you had right wingers talking about having our Reichstag fire without realizing the funny implications of that. At the time, and it comes up in this text too. I remember it being talked about right after 9/11. I mean, it's something in the logic of the modern state that propels this.
Well, you know, the Reichstag fire is an interesting case because that was done by a council communist, and then there was immediately this info war about, well, actually, no, the Nazis did it themselves, and the Nazis said, well, but he was doing it under the direction of the Soviet Union. But it didn't really matter the facts of the case. It was a perfect pretext for Hitler to seize full power. So I think this is like sort of bringing us to Sanguinetti's key argument, which is that he writes, terrorism is the absolute evil to make the entire population, which had not supported the state or had been struggling against it, believe that it at least has an enemy in common with the state, and that the state will defend the population on the condition that no one questions it. The population, which is generally hostile to terrorism and not without reason, must then agree, at least on this instance, it needs the state, which uses terrorism as the substitute for war in an era in which large-scale world wars are impossible, or in any case, it is no longer permitted to have one proletariat massacre another in an exhausting and bloody battle. So this is a really interesting point because, first of all, you do see after World War II this shift from the Bolshevik conception of mass struggle, mass parties, dual power, the workers' movement, to this fetishization of stuff like the FLN and Focoismo, the Cuban Revolution, this idea that you can get small cadres together to sort of hide out in the jungle or, in urban safe houses and launch these popular acts of bank robbing, kidnapping, attacks on the state, that sort of thing, that will inspire the population to join sides with a people's war, a protracted people's war, or what have you. And at the same time, the state is unable to necessarily directly sweep these people up because of perhaps the legitimate popularity that these actions may have in certain instances. So this leads to the necessity to infiltrate, divide and conquer these groups, or to create false flags as a justification for broader crackdowns. I think this post-war concept of like, well, a world war is no longer possible is really resonant today because it is very difficult, for example, for the U.S. military to recruit people to fight a war in the way it once did. There has to be this kind of similar logic of like the army of one, like the individual operator going and doing it. Like, you're not going to be, a member of these thousands of good American po'boys storming Normandy. You're going to be dropped in from a helicopter or from a submarine, and you're going to go, take out the Kim Jong-un or whatever. There has to be this division of labor, this clandestine nature to war now.
Well, I mean, what is fascinating is it is, if you think about the logic of the state as a legitimate holder of monopoly of violence a la Weber, in a given territory administered by a given elite. I need to add all the caveats actually that Weber adds because people drop parts of it. When it can't really do that in a mass way and it needs legitimacy, this does seem like the easiest way to get legitimacy. This or a small war, like, I don't know, Venezuela. But even that, those wars are dangerous in that they can spill over with large powers very quickly. Like, any small war becomes a proxy war between great powers today. Like, anyone, you don't have the kind of cooperation between great powers that you did in the aughts, for example, when both China and Russia were willing to support the war on terror and to be relatively quiet about what was going on in the Middle East, the U.S. was doing. That would not happen now. Even if Russia shared interests with the United States on that, it would not happen now.
Maybe I will just add a couple of points.
Sure.
The fact that this armed struggle group may make it easy to be infiltrated, this is one part. But he has like a bit more also general critique of this that he calls ideologia lotarmatista, armed strugglist ideology, I guess would be the translation. For him, this fetishism of weapons is still like a commodity fetishism.
Mm.
And he says, maybe this is what you wanted to say now, I don't know, but he said that when the time comes, there will be no problem in finding weapons, like the proletariat will seize the weapons from the bourgeoisie, from the army, from the police, and so on. Another point that he makes is that, you touched a little bit on this point already, that this ideology of armed struggle so allows the state to, so for him, this simply participates, and this is something that also one member of the Red Brigades wrote a text where he said that he agrees on this situationist critique that armed struggle allows, this kind of struggle simply participates in the spectacle of the opposed extremes, and it allows the state, so not only to be this like neutral savior of the population, but also it allows the state to, on the one hand, conceal the real workers' struggles, like the struggles of the proletariat, but at the same time to violently repress it in the name of the repression of these armed struggle groups. And it also makes, like, the so the terrorism of these armed struggle groups, it makes in the eyes of the population any kind of violent proletarian struggle something illegitimate. For him, these groups were completely divided from the real proletarian movement and struggle, and at the same time, like a product, a typical product of the society of the spectacle.
Yeah, so it's, the critiques here are, first of all, as a situationist, you know, the enemy is the spectacle. It's not like the enemy isn't, you know, Aldo Moro or Berlinger or even the state in separation. It's the way conditions are reproduced through spectacular logic, through spectacular society. And the idea of attacking even the spectacle, he says, if you don't destroy it, the spectacle will just reinforce itself. Certainly that'll be the case if you attack the spectacle through spectacular means of creating a militant group that's got these, this division of labor where you, the underlings do the actions that are called for by the leaders. And he counterposes this with their conception of revolution. He writes, "Respected hoaxers, I have only one thing to say to you. Unlike you, for the last 13 years, I have known a large number of revolutionaries in Europe. They are also known by all police forces who have contributed the most in both theory and practice to reducing capitalism to its current conditions. And without exception, none of them have ever practiced or even applauded modern spectacular terrorism. There are no secret affairs of the revolution. Today, everything that is secret belongs to power, that is to say, to the counter-revolution, and all police forces know this perfectly well." And he makes an interesting point here. And he's, you know, he's talking about the situationists, right? He's like, yeah, mm-hmm. we don't do terrorism, and we're the best revolutionaries there are. And he makes the point that this is also backfires for the state, because the police forces, instead of targeting the real proletarian struggle, which, you know, he connects to like wildcat strikes and proletarian riots and this sort of thing, they begin to train their repressive capabilities on this alienated clandestine left. And he says the police forces train themselves for civil war by shooting at sitting ducks. And just to put a cap on his sort of, you know, call to action type thing at the end of this text, he writes, "A thousand repetitions of the attacks at the Via Fani, which is where Moro's kidnapped, and Piazza Fontana will not benefit capitalism as much as a single anti-bourgeois and anti-Stalinist wildcat strike or a simple act of sabotage against production hurts it. Those who claim they want to combat alienation with alienated means, militantism, and ideology will quickly realize that they have renounced real combat. It will certainly not be the militants who will make the social revolution, nor will the secret services and the Stalinist police be able to prevent it."
And only the truth is revolutionary.
When we say the truth here, like, what does that mean in a situationist sense?
He just wrote this in this context of this
okay.
Of these paragraphs that you just read.
The truth in terms of like the state is this like massive lie. You know, that they can only lie. They can only justify themselves through, for example, liberal democracy or some kind of populism, whereas the truth is that they're just the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, that they're the spectacle, and anyone who kind of plays into that narrative is fighting on the terrain of lies, whereas the situationists or, you know, direct workers' struggles that target production are telling the truth or revealing the truth about the divisions of class society.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
He wrote how the Communist Party and the unions and these armed struggle groups are all aligned with this lie that the bourgeoisie society represents.
Mm-hmm.
And only the like worker struggles and the situationists are like, in a sense, telling the truth. And I think after this paragraph that you read, he said something that any kind of revolutionary struggle has to happen in the open.
Mm-hmm.
And revolutionary groups shouldn't use like lies and deception and things like this.
And that feeds into this vision he has that revolutionaries don't need to be stockpiling guns right now, because when the moment comes of a true revolution, the state will just have all those guns and you can just go and grab them. And that presumably comes with like mass defections of the armed forces to the sides of the revolution, which is always happens in a real revolutionary situations. And so... Yeah, I'm particularly interested in this kind of optimistic vision that he has, both because it really runs against the common concerns that leftists have that, like, well, we can't fight the state now. You know, the state's too powerful. All we can do is, you know, maybe train to defend ourselves, you know, get some guns and train to defend ourselves, like the SRA, John Brown Gun Club, Antifa fight classes, that sort of thing, which... is totally fine, but that's not this is reflection of a movement away from a concept of revolution, because you're trying to defend yourself and your community and not change anything, not envisioning a mass struggle that takes power.
Well, I mean, this is resistance logic. And the issue with resistance logic is just even in the structural metaphor implied by the name resistance, is that you are fighting a defensive and desperate survival strategy. And I think to go back to Sanguinetti's point all the way at the beginning about the only people who can really do defensive stuff is the state, because they have more to defend. Like, you know, yes, in a zero-sum game against the state, you're defending your own life. But what resources do you have to do that? I mean, it's like, you know, you can stockpile as many weapons as you want. I mean, one of the things that I always talk about with left-wingers in this regard, because I came to some of these conclusions on my own. Let's say you stockpile a bunch of weapons. And ironically, you know, like, oh, we can't fight the state. We can only defend ourselves against the state. But then the logic of stockpiling also doesn't make that much sense. Because even with right-wing groups, we know that it's really not that hard to, I don't know, set a compound on fire, or drone strike you from space, or, you know, whatever, or, you know, bomb a city block, like happened in 1981 or 82. Like, these are not hard things for the state to do. I mean, and weirdly, the entire logic is, oh, they'll come after us within the perimeters of their own border. But then also, if you really believe that, then you have to actually assess that you're in such a losing position that it wouldn't, like, that they wouldn't use the same kind of force on you because you are within their own borders that they would on outside actors, which is frankly kind of just wrong.
Yeah, I think this is what the Trump administration is gearing up for now. The terrorism designation combined with these attacks on allegedly drug smuggling fishing boats in Venezuela is that the war on terror still exists. We are still empowered as the state to kill anyone we designate as a terrorist. Drug runners are now terrorists. Leftists are now terrorists.
Oh, by leftists, we mean Democrats, though. I mean, that's the other thing. But go ahead.
The terrorism designation specifically targets anarchists, but it targets Democrats as materially supporting terrorists through Soros and stuff. So I think it might be comforting to think that this whole thing is only oriented towards the Soros Foundation and similar progressive philanthropies, but I think the two prongs of it is like the real terrorists are the anarchists, the Black Bloc, the Antifa, and then we'll use Lawfare and RICO against the progressive groups that they're connected to through the NGO structure. That seems to be the strategy.
Which, to be fair, is a strategy they've already tried. Like, I'm not talking about the Trump administration. We have to remind ourselves that this was done too under the environment, under the guise of going after quote, environmental terrorists during the Bush administration. Like this is on a much larger scale. What makes this more interesting from the standpoint of the state is that it's not the normal police and stuff that you are gearing up to do it. So like, if you look at what this does to the state itself, I mean, this actually, again, is a Sanguinetti point, right? That the spectacular thing has them fighting a lot of the wrong issues, but in ways that divide the state against itself. And if you think about, like, asking the military to play second fiddle to a bunch of irregulars that you've recruited into ICE with very little training is likely to do damage to the state's own internal apparatus. We should probably go behind the paywall for the rest of this, so this will be the fun part.
So go to patreon.com/thiswreckage if you want to hear the fun half. I thought we were already having fun, but we're going to have more fun on the other side of the paywall. And we're doing a fall promotion. You can get a couple books sent to you if you subscribe annually. You'll see the details of that on patreon.com/thiswreckage. And plug your own channel, Varn.
Yeah, and you can get the video of this at VarnBlog if you want to hear it. And I don't have anything but poetry books to give you, but I give discounts to my patrons if you want one. I don't know what they have to do with what we're talking about today, but it is something that I do. All right.